Then Tommaso Treu, who is the main organizer of the Lensing program here, asked me to give a blackboard talk. I didn't really know what it was about, what to expect. Now I see that most of you are not gravitational lens persons. Most of you are not even astronomers. And so what I try to do is give you a flavor of what gravitational lensing is and what it's used for. And that will cover some of the aspects of this week's conference. So to put it in a broad perspective, cosmology has made enormous progress in the past years. I think you're all aware of this, not the least due to the observations of the WMAP satellite. You combine this with redshift surveys from galaxies, combine that with cluster surveys, supernova surveys, and all of these information merged together into a picture which looks something like this, that the universe consists to about three quarters of a stuff that we call dark energy. The fact that it has a name doesn't mean that we understand what it is. And about 5% consists of ordinary baryons, and about 22% consists of dark matter. And even the 5% that we know what it is, namely baryons, even half of that is not observed today. We have a good guess where the baryons are hiding out, but we don't know yet. And so, based on this, cosmology, at least as I see this, has now evolved into two different lines. One line is what we would call fundamental cosmology. And the questions that one asks in this field would be, why is the density of baryons different from zero? Why are there more baryons in the universe than antibaryons? What is dark matter? What is dark energy? Was there inflation? And if so, what kind of inflation? Can we actually probe the physics of inflation? Are there some visible relics of inflation today? Are things that we call constants of physics, like the gravitational constant, or the fine structure constant, or the mass of the electron divided by the mass of the proton, are these really constants, or do they vary in time? And then the last question I want to mention here is, really Tmu nu equals Tmu nu? Is Einstein's gravity correct? And I give you a health warning at this point. I will assume that this is true, because if this is not true, you open a can of worms and this picture can just disappear. Now, there are some good indications that this is true, and I'm not going to discuss alternatives to that. On the other hand, we have the exciting field of observational cosmology, and that addresses questions like, how did the universe get reionized? The first stars, when did they form? The first black holes, when did they form? What is the formation and evolution of galaxies? We know that most of the galaxies contain a supermassive black hole, and that the supermassive black hole is closely related to the properties of the galaxies. And so we have to consider the evolution of these two ingredients together. What is the distribution of the matter in the universe, the large-scale structure? How does this evolve? What is the relation between dark matter and galaxies? Do galaxies actually follow the distribution, at least on average, of the dark matter, or are these somehow biased? And then, you know, what are the values of the cosmological constant? H0, we think H0 is known to about 5% today. The density parameters in the various species, we think, are known to about 10% at present, perhaps even better. What is the normalization of the power spectrum? Now, let me mark those questions where we think gravitational lensing can make an impact. Can make an impact on the nature of dark matter. It certainly has already made an impact on the distribution of dark matter, and from the distribution you can infer some properties of what the dark matter is made of. We think that gravitational lensing potentially will have a huge impact on studying what dark energy is, whether dark energy is a cosmological constant or whether dark energy is something more dynamical. Gravitational lensing will also make contributions about the validity of Einstein's equation. And here on that side, gravitational lensing can study the relation between dark matter and galaxies. And through that, it also makes a contribution to the formation of evolution, the formation evolution of galaxies. Lensing is very well able to study the large-scale structure of matter and its redshift distribution, and it's also able to tell us something about cosmological parameters. Perhaps lensing can also make a contribution to studying the first stars and quasars, and I will comment on this in a moment. So now I've used the word lensing few times, I should tell you gravitational lensing, what it is, and why we're doing it. So, gravitational lensing is nothing but the fact that light rays are deflected in a gravitational field, one of the predictions of Einstein's relativity, as you all know, and the observation of this deflection during a solar eclipse in 1919 made him a world-famous person, essentially overnight. So, when you have a gravitational lens situation, you typically have some mass distribution. You are here as an observer. You have some source living here. And then there are light rays from the source to the observer, and so you see the source in a direction where it's not really located, but in a different direction. Okay? One describes this typically with a number of variables. So this is the observed position of the source. This would be the position you would observe the source if the lens is not there. And the difference between those two is just the scale deflection angle alpha. And to describe that situation, you use the most simplest equation that you can think of, namely that beta is just the difference between theta and the deflection angle. Obviously, that's just a geometrical equation. Then one has distances, the distance to the deflector, the distance from the distance to the source, and the distance from the deflector to the source, and these distances just don't add up. So dd plus dds is not equal to ds because you have curved space-time. Yeah? The other important thing to note is that the lensing properties, that's all encoded here in the deflection angle, depends on what is called the dimensionless surface mass density, also called convergence. And this dimensionless surface mass density is given by the two physical surface mass density measured in grams per square centimeters divided by some so-called critical surface mass density. And to write this equation in a bit more explicit form, this is just 4 pi g dd dds over c squared ds times the integral over the line of sight times delta rho of theta and L. So you integrate the density of the lens along the line of sight, that gives you the surface mass density. I write here delta rho because have to subtract the average mean cosmic density, which in most cases is pretty irrelevant if you are dealing with an isolated galaxy, and you multiply this by the inverse of the critical surface mass density. See, the inverse, the critical surface mass density just depends on, if you know the redshifts of lens and source, it only depends on the cosmological parameters, in particular it scales with the Hubble constant. And then the deflection angle is just given as a convolution of the surface mass density by 1 over theta. You can also define a deflection potential, which is just the surface mass density convolved with ln theta. And the surface and this deflection potential satisfies a Poisson equation, namely that the Laplacian of psi is 2 times kappa. And so once you know what the surface mass density is, you can calculate the deflection angle and then get the properties of this gravitational lens. Now, light bundles are not only deflected as a whole, but you have tidal forces, and therefore light bundles will change their shape. So a circular light bundle, once it traverses such a deflector, will, to first order, be changed into an elliptical light bundle. And that is described by the tidal matrix. Tidal matrix A is d beta by d theta. By the way, all of these quantities here are two-dimensional quantities, so you can express this as a... You should view this as a two-component equation, where either beta and theta are vectors, two-dimensional vectors, or complex numbers, depending on which of the descriptions is more appropriate. And so the tidal matrix is given by 1 minus the surface mass density times the unit matrix minus, and then you have a matrix which has this general form. It's a symmetric traceless matrix. And it is this so-called shear, this gamma, that is describing the deformation of light bundles in shape. And the shear usually is considered also to be a complex number, so you take these two components of the matrix, put them into a complex number, and that is then given as the convolution of kappa times 1 over theta star squared. And I'm writing down these equations, first of all, to give you a flavor what these equations look like. All these equations are wrong by factors of 1 over pi, and so on. I think that's not important for the current purpose. The other reason I say that I show the equation is that there's a linear relation between the shear and the surface mass density, and between surface mass density and the deflection angle. So once you know one of the quantities, getting the others is you know, a linear process, and therefore pretty easy, straightforward. Finally, because you have this distortion of light bundles, not only the shape will change, but also the area of a light bundle will change. And so because the area is changed and surface brightness is conserved, there's no absorption or emission in this process involved, the apparent brightness of a source or the apparent flux of a source can change. And so one defines the so-called magnification, which is just 1 over the determinant of this matrix, that is the area distortion of the lens mapping, and this magnification describes the ratio of the flux of a source divided by the flux it would have in the absence of lensing. Okay? And that's strictly true only if you have an infinitesimal source, a very small source. If you have large sources, then the magnification has to be obtained by integrating over the surface brightness of the source. So much for the general what gravitational lensing is, and I now turn more to the why we're doing this. And gravitational lensing has quite a number of phenomena, and has actually split into subdisciplines over the past 20 years or so, 25 years. Perhaps the best known one subdiscipline is what is called strong lensing. And at Strong-Lansing, the situation one is typically dealing with is you have a mass distribution, typically a galaxy, and because of this deflection, it's possible that you see the source not only in one direction, but you actually see this, say, in four different directions. So you see the same source four times on the sky. And how is that possible? Well, the Lanz equation beta equals theta minus alpha of theta for a given beta, for a given source position, has multiple solutions theta. And then the magnifications of the various images is just the flux of the images divided by the flux of the unknown source. And since the magnification, that is the determinant of the Jacobian matrix, is different at the various image positions, the brightness of these four images is in general different. Some of these are brighter than others. The next phenomenon is arcs. Very spectacular phenomenon. So you have a cluster of galaxy dominated by its dark matter, typically. There are lots of galaxies in here. And in these clusters, you find images that looks like bananas. If you look careful, you find perhaps even counter images. They have been not found, but identified the first time in 1986. And now that we know that this phenomenon is there, they've been found in large numbers in clusters behind the core of massive clusters. And these sources, or these images, are magnified by a large factor, right? Because these images typically have a magnification of order unity, maybe two or so. The fact that they are much larger means that their light is stretched in this direction, in the tangential direction. And so the magnification of these arcs can easily exceed factors of 10 or 20 or even 50 in some cases. And so that's one of the phenomena where a gravitational lens acts as a natural telescope. It's just a light-gathering lens sitting in the sky for free of charge. And because it has 30 times as much flux as the unlensed source, means you can actually take a spectrum of this, which you couldn't do of the unlensed source. A factor of 30 in flux means a factor of 900 in exposure time. And that's the difference between something you can do and something you cannot do with a given telescope. And then there's something where you have, again, say, a galaxy, and you find around this galaxy a ring-like image. Something that Einstein predicted back in 1912 or 1913, that was only uncovered about 10 years ago in his notebooks, but they've been called Einstein rings all along. First was discovered back in 1988. Not all rings are closed. There are also rings where you find something like this, partial rings. This is a typical phenomenon if you lens the host galaxy of a quasar that typically has such a partial ring image. So why is that useful for? Well, first is gravitational light deflection, gravitational lensing is independent of the kind and the state of matter causing the gravitational field. And so gravitational lensing does not distinguish between baryonic matter or dark matter. And because baryonic matter is something you can see and subtract if you want, it's an ideal tool to study the dark matter distribution. What you can get from systems like these outlined here is the mass inside the so-called Einstein radius. The Einstein radius is the radius of this ring. The Einstein radius is the radius of a circle which traces the four images. Now that's not really a circle, but you know what I mean. Okay? And so the Einstein radius can be determined quite accurately if you have one of these lens systems. And then one finds that the mass inside the Einstein radius is given by pi times the Einstein radius times the distance square times the critical surface mass density, which only depends on the redshift of deflector and source. And so if you know the redshift of the deflector and the source, and you observe the Einstein radius, you can get the mass in a cylinder with the radius of an Einstein radius. And in many cases, we can determine this number with an accuracy of a few percent. In some cases, as one particular ring case, we can determine this number at sub-percent accuracy, which is by far the best mass determination we have in extra-electric astronomy. Maybe it's not the mass you want. Maybe it's not the virial mass, the total mass of a galaxy. That you cannot measure with that method. But it's one particular mass that you can measure very accurately, and if you had good enough models of galaxies, that's a mass that you can predict.
But it's the mass contained in the cylinder, right?
The mass contained in the cylinder centered on the lens galaxy with the Einstein radius as radius and the length essentially infinity. Where infinity means the size of the galaxy, a few hundred kiloparsec, which is still small compared to the typical distance between us and the source, which is, you know, more like gigaparsec. One can ask whether the ellipticity of the mass distribution equals the ellipticity of the light. Right? The galaxy typically has some, you know, elliptical, quote-unquote, elliptical shape. And the question is the mass distribution following this ellipse, or has it totally unrelated to this? And the answer to that question is twofold. The orientation of the mass and the light agrees quite well, typically. The axis ratio doesn't.
You're going with the light from the galaxy, which is the lens?
Yes. The mass profile. What is the density as a function of radius? Now, that's a quantity that is not particularly well constrained, this gravitational lensing. At least not alone. So, not alone with lensing, but you can add to this stellar dynamics, that is, spectroscopy of stars as a function of radius. And because lensing gives you a mass inside this radius, if you are able to measure a mass at larger or smaller radii, then you get a profile, then you get a slope. And one of the pioneers, or two of the pioneers of these techniques, are actually sitting in the audience, Leon and Tommaso. The core radius of galaxies, of the mass of galaxies, is small. And we know that just from the fact that there are four images and not a fifth one. In fact, there should be a fifth one. The fifth one should be very close to the core of the galaxy. But in nearly all cases, we don't see it. And the reason why we don't see that is, well, all of the images have different magnifications. And so if the magnification is small, if it's a hundredth or even smaller, then the flux of the central image would be small enough to escape detection. And you can get a small magnification if you have a high value of kappa in the core of the galaxy. And so the absence of the odd image tells us that kappa should be high in the center of the galaxy, meaning that the core radius is small. For many years, the determination of the Hubble constant was seen as one of the main applications of gravitational lensing. And the way you can do that is simply suppose I can make a little sketch here. Suppose you have a multiple image system like this with the galaxy sitting here. And suppose you have a larger universe. Okay. Then the observables in these two universes would be pretty much the same. All the angles agree, all the, you know, axis ratios would agree. The only difference is, in the larger universe, it takes time longer to travel from the source to us. Now, since you have light moving along two different ray paths, there is no reason to assume that the light travel time from here over this ray is the same as the light travel time over this ray. So in general, there will be a time delay. This time delay is in principle unobservable, because if the source makes a hiccup, then, you know, several billion years later, the observer will see the hiccup first in image A and later in image B. And so if you have a variable source, you can measure the time delay. And then the time delay is proportional to the size of the universe. The size of the universe is 1 over the Hubble constant. And then it depends on the difference between the square of the deflection angle minus the deflection potential. And so, if you can measure a time delay, and if you understand your lens well enough that you actually know the deflection angle and the deflection potential, then you can determine the Hubble constant. Now, this depends on the mass profile. And as I said, the mass profile is not very well constrained by gravitational lensing alone. And so after the first time delays have been measured, we know about 15 lens systems at the moment where time delays have been measured, it was a bit of a sobering finding that we don't understand the mass distribution well enough to get a precision measurement of the Hubble constant. You can turn this around. We think we know the Hubble constant to within 5%. And so you plug the Hubble constant in here, and then you get information on the mass profile once you measure the time delay. Yeah? And there's in our community, there is a certain bimodality of philosophy. Some people think, you know, make plausible assumption about the mass profile, get the Hubble constant. Other people think, you know what the Hubble constant is, try to get the mass profile. So there's a very fruitful interaction. The nice thing about this method of getting the Hubble constant is you don't need a distance ladder. You don't need to measure the distance to the Large Magellanic Cloud, calibrate your Cepheids there, use the Cepheids to measure the distance to Virgo, use Tully-Fisher relation and other secondary distance indicators. Here you measure the Hubble constant in a single step, so to speak. And that's the beauty of this method.
The time delay is one number.
Yes.
So how much can we get one number of the mass profile out of it? You can't get much of a function.
No. What you do is, look, these images have different radial distance from the center of the mass. And so you take the closest one, say this, say you take, you measure a time delay between this pair of images. And then what you get are two circles, the one that traces the inner one, the other, the outer one. And what this number here is sensitive to is the slope in the annulus. That's what enters actually this relation here. And that is something you can fix if you assume you know what the Hubble constant is. And then finally, I said that these magnifications can be very large. In arcs, we see that the magnifications are very large. And in fact, one might expect that one has some sources in the sky where the magnification is, you know, is really huge. As it turns out, for many source populations at high redshift, the apparently most luminous species of the source population is strongly gravitational lensed. And I'll give you three examples. CB58 is by far the apparently most luminous redshift 3 galaxy that we know of. Okay? It's about, you know, 10 factor of 10 more luminous than any other corresponding Lyman Break galaxy. And we know it's gravitationally lensed by a cluster of galaxies, and the magnification is of order 30. There is a quasar, APM 08, I forgot the rest of the number, I have it on paper, it's not so important. That quasar is at redshift 4, you know, very distant. It has an apparent brightness of 15th magnitude, and it's just 2 magnitudes fainter than the brightest quasar in our local environment, 3C273. And third, there is a source called F10214. That's an infrared galaxy at redshift 2.2, by far the apparently most luminous galaxy discovered by the IRIS satellite, and we know it's magnified by a factor of about 50 to 70, depending on the exact wavelength you look at this. And so there is a certain tendency that the apparently most luminous object of a given species is gravitationally magnified. So I'm now wipe out the blackboard, and that is an appropriate time for you to ask questions if you have some.
Okay, question. You said that the lensing would teach us about the kind of dark matter, but then you also say it's independent of the kind and state of dark matter.
Yes.
So that's a question.
I can give you a few examples how this is connected. One is, if dark matter is cold, then it will form small scale structures, will form very compact and low density mass concentrations. If dark matter would be, you know, relativistic neutrinos, then you can only form the very big ones. So the fact that you see very compact mass distributions tells you it cannot be made out of neutrinos. A second, and perhaps more interesting connection of the dark matter lensing one is, we think that dark matter is weakly interacting. Now, suppose it would not be weakly interacting, but dark matter particles can actually scatter, elastically scatter. Then, if the scattering cross-section is not small enough, you would never form arcs, because the mass distribution inside clusters would be just, you know, smoothed out because of the scattering. And so we have, due to the presence of arcs, already very good upper limits on the scattering cross-section. So these are two.
If we assume that the dark matter is weakly interacting massive particles, then can, within that structure, can it still tell us more?
No, I don't think so. And you may have noticed my cross on the dark matter was smaller than on some others. And that was deliberately so. I personally think that progress in dark matter will, you know, the next steps in progress in dark matter will not come from astronomy, but will come from accelerators or underground labs. So the cold dark matter cosmology has been tremendously successful, as you know, but nevertheless there are two things that are called CDM crises. The first CDM crisis has to do with the fact that simulations of cold dark matter predict a certain density profile. So simulations tell us that the density profile has a particular form, and this form is cuspy. So it does not have a flat core, but it goes, you know, right onto the origin with some sort of power loss load. Now, you try to measure this. If you want to measure this, the best way of measuring this is a rotation curve of galaxies. I remind you, that dark matter in galaxies has been found by looking at the rotation curves of spiral galaxies. And so fall rot as a function of radius. Now the problem is that galaxies do not only contain dark matter but also baryons. Baryons are dissipative, and therefore what you measure is first the superposition of dark matter and baryons, and second, because baryons are dissipative, they contract, and by contracting they take some of the dark matter with it, and so the dark matter profile gets also modified in the contraction of the baryons. And so if you use the rotation curve, say, of our Milky Way, it will not follow the CDM predicted dark matter profile. However, there are galaxies called LSBs, low surface brightness galaxies, and we think that low surface brightness galaxies are totally dominated by dark matter. They have very little baryons because they have low surface brightness, that is, they formed little stars, and they probably have also little gas. And so one thinks LSBs are dominated by dark matter. And so this CDM profile would predict a rotation curve that goes like this, and what one measures is typically something like this. And there is discrepancy, and that has not been found in one galaxy, but in samples of galaxies. This is called the first dark matter crisis. How to resolve this? Now, there are various ways of resolving this. First is observation. As the name says, low surface brightness galaxies have a low surface brightness. And therefore, it is sometimes very challenging to predict where is the dynamic at center of the galaxy, around which point should the rotation curve be measured. If you get that wrong, then whatever you do, you smooth out the velocity profile. Now, that's perhaps an explanation for some galaxies, but probably not the whole truth. Second is that the rotation of gas is not like you would imagine in the most simple picture, that gas is in a very flat disk and the disk has, you know, circular rotational speed around the center of the galaxy, but the mass distribution, as predicted from CDM, has little subclumps. And so the potential is not smooth, and so the gas is not flat, and it's not moving on circular orbits. And so what people have done is they just filled gas into a dark matter potential and observed, you know, the gas as observers would do this to get a rotation velocity. And what this clumpiness does is it transforms such rotation curves more to such rotation curves. Whether that's sufficient or not, you know, people debate this. And third, you have evolution. So we don't know what makes a low surface brightness galaxy. What's the difference? Why are spiral galaxies like ours formed, and why are low surface brightness formed? Probably it's an evolutionary effect. And unless we understand this evolutionary effect, maybe the baryons have not only contracted by forming the galaxy in the first place, but blown out the baryons by some explosive events like supernova, and just made the dark matter profile more shallow. Now that has nothing to do with lensing. I go to the second crisis of dark matter, and that is called substructure.
Can you ask a question?
Yeah.
There was a proposal years ago by people like Spergel and Steinhardt that interactions could smooth out these cores. But is that ruled out by your comment about the arcs, Gordy, or is there a possibility that you smooth out the cores?
No, I think that this constraint is stronger.
That's stronger.
And the problem of substructure comes from the following observation. Take a 10 to the 15 solar mass halo in a numerical simulation. That's a big cluster. Then one finds it contains hundreds of halos with mass larger than about 10 to the 9 solar masses. That agrees with observations, because these subhalos and clusters are observed. They're called galaxies. Now you take a halo with a mass of 10 to the 12 solar masses, and then the simulations predict that you have hundreds of substructures with mass larger than about 10 to the 6 solar masses. Basically, it's scale independent because the shape of the perturbations in the universe follow nearly a power law of a wide range of scales, and therefore you just can scale these two. The problems are they are not observed. So, for example, in our Milky Way, we know less than about 20 satellite galaxies. Although one should admit, over the past years, several more have been detected. And now the fact that they are not seen has two solutions. Solution number one is they are not there. Or they're dark. Now, one can distinguish between those two. Namely, the galaxy mass distribution if they're not there should be smooth, and if they are there but dark should be clumpy. And that's something that gravitational lensing has power to detect. This
should be clumpy at the scale of one part of the moon.
Yes. Even one part in 10 to the 12. I tell you. Potentially even one part in 10 to the 15. Okay, here's now what observations tell you. For nearly all gravitational lens systems, where you have four images, it's easy, if you have some experience, it's easy to find simple mass distributions kappa such that theta I minus alpha of theta I equals theta j minus alpha of theta j, meaning that you satisfy the lens equation for all images. And that's a non-trivial statement, in that if you have a quartz system like this, you typically have one more constraint than you have free parameters in the model. And so the fact that you can find such a model is not trivial. I should also point out that in some cases, we know the image positions to better than a tenth of a milliarcsecond because we have VLBI observations. Given that the scale here is typically an arcsecond, meaning is that we can fit the image position at a level of 10 to the minus 4 with a simple mass model. But in no case, or nearly no case, of quad image, we get that the flux ratios equals the magnification ratios. And remember, the magnification ratios are predicted by the surface mass density. So we fit the image positions easily, but these simple models don't give the flux ratios. And so that's the flux discrepancies. Now, you may say, probably we have taken the wrong kappa. Yes and no. we have obviously taken the wrong kappa, because if we had taken the right kappa, then we would get the flux ratios right. Now, when I mean simple models, I mean smooth models, where the mass distribution is a smooth function as a function of position. And there are some systems where actually these flux discrepancies are independent on what smooth function you choose. And so they're independent, really, of the big mass model. There are some universality relations that the images of gravitational lenses satisfy, and they're independent from the details of your modeling. And even in those cases, in particular in those cases, you violate this. Now, here's the trick.
Independent, assuming it's smooth.
Assuming that's smooth, yes.
What does smooth mean?
Smooth means that that you do not have strong variations of kappa, you know, three oscillations between these two images. That's what I mean with smooth. Yeah. And one can actually quantify this in individual systems. You can actually do a Fourier decomposition and ask, what is the lowest Fourier mode that you can... Yeah, some sort of. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the image position tell us this is not a bad assumption.
What is the unique?
No, there isn't. It's not unique. Yeah.
Because you have all point differences.
Because you essentially want to fix a two-dimensional function, kappa, which depends on two positions, with about 8 observables. And so it cannot be unique. Only if you make the assumption that it's smooth and behaves like you expect galaxies to behave. I mean, the galaxy mass distribution is not assumed to increase outwards. Typically, it's assumed to decrease outwards. So we know quite a bit about galaxies from stellar dynamics. Solution to this is that the deflection angle we have seen is the gradient of the potential at its first order derivative. The magnification depends on kappa and gamma, and therefore is a function of the second derivative of the potential. If we look at this in Fourier space, this is k times psi, and this is k squared times psi. So if you take small scale inhomogeneities, and these small scale inhomogeneities do not very much to psi, do a little more to alpha, but not very much, but can do a lot to the second derivative of psi, and therefore to the magnification. Okay? And that is what we call substructure. Now, why CDM substructure? Is that story that I just told you related to this here? That's the question. And that's a question that is not fully answered, and there's some discrepancy, some controversy in the community about this, and I'm sure this will be something that we are going to discuss in the next 4 days. Why some people think it's CDM substructure? Well, first is this problem here was discovered in 1999, at least was put out in a very well publicized and very well cited paper by Ben Moore and colleagues in 1999. If they had thought about the consequences of this, they probably would have come up with, you know, that should be seen in gravitational lensing, and they should have made this prediction. Unfortunately, in 1998, this already was pointed out, and so that prediction was no longer made. But in principle, this flux discrepancy is a prediction of CDM models. So, it's prediction. C Second, the tip of the iceberg is seen. That is, we have at least two systems where we not only have a discrepancy in the flux ratios, but we also are unable to fit the image positions at the accuracy with which we can observe them. So there is this one system I have image A here, image B here. Image C has a complex structure. It has, you know, just for simplicity, it has a double image, and each of the images consists of two components. I'm exaggerating all of this here. Having a picture would be easier, but okay, it's a blackboard talk. And so these two are double images, these two are double images. Every simple model, every smooth model predicts that this separation equals that separation. You look at the map, that's not true. These separations are different. And so you don't fit your image constraint. If you look carefully on HST images, you see a little blip here. This little blip has about 1% of the light of this galaxy. If you now put 1% of the mass of the galaxy into this blip, you explain the image separation. And so you can actually see, perhaps, we don't even know whether this blip is at the same redshift of the galaxy, but perhaps it is. If it is, what this would be is a satellite galaxy. It would be a large Magellanic cloud of this galaxy, and the mass of the Magellanic cloud is sufficient to cause this astromagnetic perturbation. However, we know that there is other substructure in galaxies. Unfortunately, for that purpose, galaxies contain stars. And even a single star is able to change the magnification, provided that the source is sufficiently small. The source has to be smaller than the Einstein radius. That I've okay, it's gone. And the Einstein radius is about 10 to the 15 centimeters. So mu affected for source radii less than about 10 to the 15 centimeters. And we know that the optical continuum region of quasars and the X-ray emitting region of quasars is of that size or even smaller. And so what you now have is this galaxy. This galaxy consists of stars, the background source. In the course of time, the galaxy moves with respect to the line of sight, or the quasar moves. Certainly there's a relative change of transverse position. And so you can picture this as if the source moves across a field of stars. And because it's doing this, the magnification changes all the time, because small sources are sensitive to, you know, stellar masses. And what you would get is a change of the flux. That's called gravitational microlensing. And gravitational microlensing has first been observed in the early 90s. By now there are, you know, about 10 systems, or perhaps even 15 systems, where we know that microlensing has been observed just for monitoring the flux of various images. If this flux variations would be intrinsic to the source, then the variation you see in that image should appear somewhat later in the other one. But if you see unrelated variations, well, that's gravitational microlensing.
Stars
I could see the bunches of stars, not an individual one. Although, no, you cannot see Jupiters as far as I know in other galaxies, but you can see Jupiters in our galaxy. We can actually see a planet. We have detected a planet that has about 6 Earth masses by gravitational lensing. Yeah. And the reason why you can do this in our galaxy and not in other galaxies is you have multiple images, they always occur at places where the surface mass density is high, where this kappa that I've defined here is of order 0.5. And that is the star fields are dense. And therefore you don't see individual stars, but you only see the collective action of many stars. In our galaxy, when you look to the galactic bulge, the optical depth, the corresponding kappa, is of order 10 to the minus 7. And so there's one star acting at a time, one star with its planet acting at a time.
What is the time scale for the variation?
Time scale for the variation is of order years. You know, months to years. And basically it has to do with the fact that this is the Einstein radius, 10 to the 15 centimeter. And the typical velocity of objects, transverse velocity of order, 300 kilometers a second, so a thousandth of the velocity of light, and 10 to the 15 centimeters is a thousandth of a light year, and so the typical time scale is about a year. There are some cases where the variations are faster, there are some cases where it's slower.
What is the time scale for the relative time delay between two images?
The smallest one that has been measured is, I think, of order a day. And the largest one, water's not around, the largest one I think is 417 days. But typically it's of order a month or so. So, unfortunately, this is an effect that occurs, but fortunately we know that radio sources are, some of the cases at least, spatially resolved with VLBI, and so we know that their radius is 10 to the 18 centimeters and stars essentially do not play a role there. So microlensing can serve as an explanation for the flux discrepancy in the optical, but most likely can't be an explanation for flux discrepancies in the radio. Now, in the radio, you have other effects. You have interstellar scattering, scintillation, and that can change the fluxes compared to the predictions of the lens model. And we had a meeting about 2 months ago, and there were strong arguments of whether we found a single system where all of the other explanations are excluded, either of those. And I think the conclusion was perhaps one. There's one that probably is the golden discrepancy, if you like. There's also some discrepancy or some uncertainty of the model predictions. Whereas this is a clear prediction from CDM models, what is not fully clear yet is what the spatial distribution of these subhalos are. Are the subhalos spread evenly throughout the galaxy, or are the subhalos in the central part of the galaxy dissolved by tidal forces? That's something where the numerical modelers are arguing about. So I've used up my hour, and I think I'm not telling you anything but the very exciting field of weak gravitational lensing, maybe at a different opportunity. Thank you very much for your attention.
So any questions from the non-experts?
So for a non-expert, what is the definition of strong versus weak lensing?
Essentially, if you have strong lensing, you look at a picture, you see you have lensing, I'm kidding. So, four images, strong distortions, rings, you have a lensing phenomenon. Weak lensing is something where you take a source and you distort it by 5%. So you take a round source and you make an ellipse with an axis ratio of 0.9521. That is something you cannot see with your naked eyes, because galaxies do not come round intrinsically. They come with an intrinsic ellipticity dispersion. And so you can only see this effect in a statistical sense.
Okay, well, that's time for your attention.